Christian Blood, KTSA News.
Jonathan Turley, the Georgetown law professor, said, it's like finding two people in a bank vault and only taking one of them to jail. I think that's a pretty apt description of what happened today with this judge in Georgia, Scott McAfee, in the Fannie Willis ruling. So I'm sure you've heard by now. Fannie Willis, the DA for Fulton County, wants to bring a RICO case against former President Donald Trump and several other people. She hired a lead prosecutor named Nathan Wade without any felony case experience, slept with him, paid him taxpayer dollars. He proceeded to buy her vacations and take those vacations with her, which she claims to have, without any proof, reimbursed him for in cash, only in cash. But again, no ATM slips, no indication or demonstration of cash she ever had or where she got it. But it was always available because her daddy told her to have a lot of cash around. You get the feeling that there's two ways to look at this. Some people are very angry because it looks like the judge split the baby, but very unwisely. Essentially, the judge came down and said, well, this looks bad, so we're going to require that Nathan Wade be taken off the case or resign from it. Or if you don't do that, Fannie Willis, then you have to disqualify yourself and your office from it. And given that choice, we learned a short time later that Nathan Wade resigned from the case. So Fannie Willis, in a statement, says she will proceed with the case, and officially, at least, Nathan Wade is off of it. One way to look at this is that the judge really punted. I mean, he split in half, like Jonathan Turley said. Two people who both testified in the same way, who were both part of the same relationship, a relationship that was wrong and unethical for both of them. One is disqualified and the other one escapes consequences. But then the other way to look at this is, and I've heard people say this today too, leaving her on the case but wounding her with these findings maybe helps Trump in the sense that now the case looks even shakier and more corrupt going forward than it did to us before we knew all of this. If you believe that, however, you have to believe that the jury in this case will be impartial, will come into it unaffected by any opinions, and then will receive the info and the reality of what Fannie Willis did with an open mind. I don't know that I believe that. So to me, I'm coming down on the side of this is just more loss of faith, loss of credibility for the criminal justice system. And of course, all of this diverts attention from the fact that on the merits, Willis's charges against Donald Trump are weak at best and don't deserve to go to trial. And we're in a very dangerous point here because day after day, people like you who walk the straight and narrow path, who do everything right, who were brought up to respect authority, who, if not through upbringing, just through your own nature, defer to and show respect for the rule of law, are watching on display a banana republic, a complete perversion of almost a joke series of prosecutions. I don't know how far we can go with this before one of the most important pillars holding our society up, which is that most people do the right thing and obey the law because they respect the system, the process, I don't know how much longer we can go before that collapses. Before people will not trust, I mean, we're already at a point where I fear that people will not trust election and election results. It's hard to believe and trust government experts over the last 4 years. And a lot of you calling this show over the years have come down on the side of the police and law and order. You said we have to have it. We have to defer to it. We can't have a society. We can't have a civil society without it. But that system that you've defended and that you are maybe still respectful of is disrespecting you and putting on a show. How do you separate? I mean, it's not even worth asking the question, but how could you logically separate Nathan Wade from Fannie Willis? So if she dumps him, the case can continue, says the judge. Now, that's not the final word. Either side could appeal the judge's decision. But it seems to me the conflict of interest was written by her, created by her. And I wonder how he decided or how he would justify deciding something like this. I don't think it really, we're going to bring on a legal expert, and I don't want to step all over that. But to me, honestly, and I'm not a lawyer, and you know that, the only way I can see this, unless he changes my mind in 20 minutes, the only way I can see this is that a deal was made, a deal was cut, and she was told, we have to do something, we have to throw them something. So we're going to throw them Nathan Wade. You're going to have to be okay with that. I don't know if she was or not, but she was told she had to be, and he was probably told, look, you need to just step down. You've had your fun. You've gotten paid. But somebody has to be, you know, somebody has to go down for this, and it's going to be you. Tell me what you think. 210-599-5555. A survey this week from Gallup said that 30%, nearly 30%, of young women in America, Gen Z women, are LGBTQ. That would be a record. Almost 30% of Gen Z women identify as LGBTQ, mostly as bisexual, says Gallup. And the group most likely to identify as LGBTQ was Gen Z women. And in that breakdown, bisexuals made up the highest percentage, over half. Part of me has a hard time believing this is true, because it obviously flies in the face of evolutionary theory. But part of me thinks it might be true, in that this might be what they told the surveyors. There are massive social incentives to give this answer, especially among young people. Saying this would be like saying, I'm open-minded. I'm not closed-minded. I'm not a judge of people. The thing we have to figure out here is not, is the survey accurate, or did they mean it when they said it? The thing we have to figure out is there so much societal pressure to give an answer like this that it's really not the answer, in which case, as these women age, they will distribute themselves in a more predictable way. I mean, obviously some people are bisexual and some people are gay, but nearly 30% of one generation? What would that mean to the birth rate? What would that mean to shrinking societies, which are dying societies, obviously? This isn't me attacking anybody, but I have to think that this answer probably represents social pressure plus experimentation. That if ever there's a time in your life you would be experimental or confused, it would be when you're the youngest. And step back for a minute from the way you'd look at this and your experience and consider what these Gen Zers have grown up with, the culture they've grown up with, which is not the one we grew up with, the examples set for them, which were not the examples set for us, and it almost starts to make sense that they would give this answer. And again, I don't know that it's an answer that really means anything. I almost feel like they could have tacked, the Gallup people could have tacked on the words, "for now," to this finding. But let's throw that open too. 210-599-5555 if you have thoughts about that. Democratic Congressman Vicente Gonzalez, in an article published this week, says that Hispanics who support former President Trump are like Jews for Hitler. Are like Jews for Hitler. For Republicans to stay in power, they need to convince at least a percentage of Latinos to start voting Republican. He wrote in the New Republic. If not, they'll eventually lose elections. The rhetoric you hear from the Republican Party is shameful and disgraceful for Latinos, he wrote. And you know, when you see Latinos for Trump, to me, it is like seeing Jews for Hitler. Jews for Hitler. Well, he's not holding anything back, is he? They must be panicking, the Democrats. They must be seeing internal numbers and polling that is freaking them out. Because you can't climb down from that statement. You can't walk that one back. You can't say, well, I only kind of meant it, or sort of meant it, or I was taken out of context. You can't. Jews who supported Hitler, by the way, I don't know how many of them there were, but that's as far as you can go. So what you're saying is Hispanic voters who vote for Trump are voting for their extermination? For their enforced enslavement and liquidation? That's the plan? That's the Trump plan? That's what Republican policies are for? And how does that sound to a person that maybe is undecided? I know what it's supposed to sound like. It's supposed to sound like, don't even think about it. But it's so over the top. And again, I don't know. I'm not the intended audience, but I don't know. It's so over the top. It would make me think these people cannot be taken seriously. I may not know if I'm going to vote for Trump, but I know I'm not going to vote for people that just told me I'm a self-defeating, self-hating, self-exterminating person, because that would be like agreeing with them that I'm an idiot. I've got a dunce cap on. I can't come in from out of the rain. I don't even know what's good or bad for me. Notice there's no attempt to break down or dissect what exactly is wrong with Trump's policies. We've given up on that a long time ago. And as we've talked about on this show, part of the reason that isn't brought up is because those policies are actually pretty middle of the road. They're not extreme. They're mostly stuff that both parties in this country used to agree to and agree on. Trump mostly proposes stuff that we should have been doing and used to be doing all along. He didn't have a lot of, like, way out there, crazy, let's connect with the aliens kind of ideas. So you got to go for the extreme comparison, and this is it. I mean, you can't get right. I mean, Jews for Hitler, you can't do better than that. Once you've used that up, nothing else is half as strong. I keep thinking that in a perfect world, the prosecution of Donald Trump would be so important that you would put the very best, brilliant, crafty, capable minds on it. And I don't know, like maybe this Jack Smith is a sharp guy. I don't know. But I look at Fannie Willis. I look at Letitia James. I look at Alvin Bragg. And they don't seem too bright. They don't seem too capable. They kind of look like they're in over their heads. If you remember the testimony, when Fannie Willis was on the stand and they had her on the money thing and the cash payments and stuff, and she got all rattled. And at one point she said, "My proof is that I told you," which is a nonsense statement. That's like your 3-year-old holding her breath because you won't buy the Lucky Charms. You know, it's the last gasp, you know, of a desperate person with no ammo. So then I think, okay, well, I know that taking down Trump or stopping him or dirtying him up is important. So, and they've put not very bright people on that mission. So what does that tell me? It tells me that you don't really have to win this thing. The fix is already in. Like, even Fannie Willis can get this verdict. That's how it looks to me. I don't know, but that's how it looks. Because if I thought this was on the up and up and it was really going to come down to who has the best case and who makes the best argument and evidence, then I would assume you would send much stronger legal talent out to the mound to pitch the inning. But because they haven't, I think they figure, and maybe even know, they're going to get the verdicts they want. That is already decided. And when people look at that and they see that, and then they look at elections and they think, do the people at the top who are pretending to contest this election actually already know how it's going to end? It gets a little crazy, right? I mean, what if the reason Biden is there is because they're not worried about the normal factors that you would think would contribute to or in some way make unlikely his reelection? Maybe they just know. It would be like if you were, if they were having a drawing in your office for a prize and everybody had a ticket. And everybody was wondering if they were holding the winning ticket, but you knew you were going to win the prize. You would have to act like you were just as on the edge as everybody else. You were just as nervously anticipatory as everybody else, but it would be an act in your case because you would actually know I'm getting the prize. I look at these court proceedings. I look at the way the election's being managed. That's how it looks to me. I don't mean to be pessimistic, but that's how it looks to me. Like, these are not good people. This is not the best and brightest. Yet it's for all the marbles. So if you didn't send the best for something that's really important, it must not take being the best to win it. And maybe that also explains on a daily basis the kind of bananas stories like Vicente Gonzalez saying Jews for Hitler. Because, again, that would sound like a very boneheaded thing to say to an angered electorate unless you already knew we don't really need those people. We're not worried about it. We're not sweating bullets over how the Hispanic vote goes. I hope I'm wrong. Convince me I'm wrong, I'll be grateful to you. Don't just tell me I'm wrong, like, because you want me to be or you don't want to hear this, but If you know I'm wrong, I would love to hear the explanation for it. But that's just one idea that I have when I look at this. I think it's just, these are just not the best people for stuff that's really very, very, very important. Joining the show now in the KTSA Connecticut Quality Water Softeners Newsmaker line is Cornell Professor of Law and the founder of LegalInsurrection.com, Professor William Jacobson. Professor, great to have you back with us. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me back.
Let me start with the judge, Scott McAfee's decision on Fannie Willis. What do you think?
Well, it was a little strange. He tried to be somewhat cautious in his decision, and I don't think necessarily each of the little parts was wrong, but the end result was very bizarre. The end result was he found that two people engaged in the appearance of impropriety, and rather than making a decision, he left it up to them and said, one of you has to leave. Well, why not both of them? That was the strange part. And why leave it up to them to choose?
And why would you do that?
I think, again, he was being extremely cautious. He did not want to essentially disrupt the entire prosecution. He, I assume, believes that that's the right result. But I don't think it makes any sense if you have found that while there wasn't a direct conflict of interest, which requires dismissal of the prosecutor, which would be Fannie Willis, but you found that Fannie Willis and the special prosecutor assigned for this engaged in the appearance of impropriety, I think they should have both been kicked off. So I think it's the wrong result. I just think he was being extremely cautious about this.
I don't know about the law, but in a lot of professions, the professional standards which are drilled into you are such that the appearance of impropriety is pretty much on the same par as impropriety, that you're supposed to avoid the appearance of it as much as you're avoiding the actual commission of it. And I mean, doesn't this just pollute not only her case, but really people's perception of the whole system?
Well, it should. It should. Whether it will with whatever particular jury they end up seating in this case is the big question. But these are prosecutors. They're held to a higher standard than a private practice, you know, or somebody representing an individual litigant. I mean, these prosecutors have enormous power. They have the power of the state behind them, and they have to act to a higher standard. And that's why whatever was going on here, had they been simply two attorneys representing individual clients in a case, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal. But, you know, they brought this prosecution under very suspect circumstances that at least led to the potential conclusion that there was a financial motivation. I know the judge said it hadn't been proven enough, but there's certainly the suggestion of that. And there's a very strong suggestion, even in his opinion, that people were less than truthful on the witness stand. And he said, well, that's not for me to determine in the context of this motion. And he even mentioned, well, maybe that's for the state bar. Maybe that's for other disciplinary officials. But, you know, when you have that, you have the combination of everything he found that went wrong here, the suggestion that perhaps there was perjury in his courtroom, but he didn't have to deal with it right now, when one of the people involved in that potential improper testimony are the prosecutors. I don't think he went far enough. I really don't. Not in such a highly politicized case like this, highly unusual case.
Are you still with us? Okay, yeah, I think we just lost that line. Don, if you could try to get him back on. I think we lost that connection, and we'll get Professor Jacobson back. Let me read some of what McAfee wrote. He wrote, there was no actual conflict, his words, in the relationship. But then he wrote, this finding is by no means an indication that the court condones this tremendous lapse in judgment or the unprofessional manner of the district attorney's testimony during the evidentiary hearing. And it just seems like it seems like we're splitting a very, very fine hair. Let me see if we have the professor back with us. Professor, can you hear us again?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I was just reading the part where the judge said no actual conflict, but then wrote, this finding is by no means an indication that the court condones this tremendous lapse in judgment. Georgia law does not permit the finding of actual conflict for simply making bad choices, even repeatedly. I mean, it seems so careful. It seems like the bare minimum. It seems like he did the least he could possibly do.
I agree. He was overly cautious here. I mean, in a high-profile prosecution like this, in an unprecedented prosecution like this, which is so thoroughly tainted, not just with politics, not just with her statement, which the judge didn't deal with recently before at a black church, accusing her critics of being racist and playing the race card. This whole thing stinks. It really does. I mean, this is a prosecution that should be clean as a whistle when you're going after the former president of the United States and a couple of dozen other people for alleged conspiracy to illegally overturn the election, and you've got prosecutors acting like this, they should be off the case. This is a travesty. That doesn't mean the prosecution shouldn't go forward. They should have been kicked off the case, and to my understanding, under Georgia law, if the prosecutor, the district attorney, gets removed from a case, it would go to a different office. So it would still go forward. The case would have gone forward, but why are we having this high-profile case with this taint to it? It's not right.
When you look at the effects of leaving her in place, and you mentioned that we don't know how it'll affect the jury and how how biased this jury might be to begin with. It's in a county that President Biden carried by 73%. You also have to ask, I think, as I'm sure you do, how does this make people in general look at the criminal justice system? I mean, the Trump prosecutions are turning out to be, one after another, remarkably iffy, if not inept.
Yeah, I mean, they smell of politics all over the place. I mean, it was just revealed that the prosecution in the New York City case, which is on the fastest track, had not turned over 10,000 pages of documents.
Yeah.
So now it's going to be delayed. What is going on here? And what's going on here is that the prosecutors wanted to have these cases go to trial in an election year. Fannie Willis could have brought this case 2 years ago. New York City could have brought the case 2 years ago, and we'd be done with it. But this was political decisions by all of the prosecutors, with the exception of the Florida case, because the facts in the Florida case came up after, you know, much later than the other ones. But all these other cases are dealing with facts either from several years ago, like, you know, New York City, or 2020. There's no reason we should be in an election year. And that's what part of the problem here is. These prosecutors wanted their cases to get to trial within months of the general election. And that's why this whole thing stinks.
Professor William Jacobson, read him at legalinsurrection.com. Professor, thanks for the time today. We appreciate it.
Great. Take care.
445 on San Antonio's News Talk Station, 550 and 1071 KTSA. We can talk about this, 210-599-5555. What's your theory? I'm beginning to think that the particular places that cases have been brought are so favorable to the selection of an anti-Trump jury that the sort of competence factor is not a factor. I mean, if you're in front of a jury that is predisposed to convict Trump, I guess you can send anybody, and they are sending anybody to try the case. If they were really worried about winning this thing on its merits, if they were really worried about an impartial jury, you know, 12 angry men, whatever, scrutinizing the facts, I can't imagine. I just cannot imagine that anybody would say Fannie Willis, Alvin Bragg, these are people that, you know, Letitia James, these are people we will send forth. These are the best. These are the all-stars. This is the dream team of American jurisprudence. 210-599-5555. Do you know who Michael Imperioli is? Michael Imperioli was on The Sopranos, and now he's in a play in New York called An Enemy of the People. During last night's performance of the play, environmental nuts started heckling. They stopped the play. There were several of them in the audience. They were yelling things like, "No theater on a dead planet," to stop the performance. One of them got on stage and made a statement about how the oceans are rising and they'll swallow the city and this entire theater will be swallowed whole. The water is coming for us, screamed one of them. Michael Imperioli and one of the other actors in the play shouted them down. And the audience applauded. Finally. Finally. I've been watching these things. I know you have too, for years. I've been watching people block traffic, even blocking the president's motorcade last week. I've been watching people lock themselves onto doors and glue themselves to things and disrupt joyous occasions, celebratory occasions, grab the spotlight for themselves away from people who deserved it and had waited for it. And I've been waiting for people to stop being surprised, shocked, stunned, and to tell them to shut the F up. And then the next thing that needs to happen is beatdowns. I'm sorry. Call me advocating violence. But it will only take a few. These are not alpha males, okay? It'll only take a few. I said this too when people were doing crazy things on airplanes, trying to open the doors and stuff on airplanes. The people on the airplane should rip that person apart, okay? And the shouting down and the retaliation needs to be happening. We're all sick and tired of hearing from them. We're all sick and tired of them taking over and commandeering our lives. They have no credibility, and they can't get you to listen any other way but to force their way in and stop other people's audiences. They need someone else's audience in order to have an audience. And we've been too nice and too patient for too damn long about this. So good for him. I'll watch any movie or show he's in now. And more people need to do what he did. And I don't even know what his politics are. I mean, I don't even care, even if you agree. We're doing a play here. Where did you grow up? Who raised you? These people paid money. We rehearsed. We're doing a play. We're doing a thing here. This is our thing. You go get your thing. You go draw an audience. And people are letting it happen. We've been letting it happen. That's why it happens. Same thing with blocking the streets. It wouldn't happen if you couldn't get away with it. And they get away with it because we're so stunned and polite that we stand there like, I can't believe somebody's doing this. And in that moment of being stunned and being passive, they get away with it. Enough, I say. The judge in Florida questioning yesterday why Donald Trump's the only president who's ever been charged with his handling of classified material and giving a hint as to what might be the grounds for an appeal in the Florida documents case. I want to play for you what I think is a good sort of synopsis or analysis of what's happening with that case. And I know the name Julie Kelly is probably familiar to you. She's been on our show before. She writes for American Greatness and is a frequent guest on conservative cable. This is what she thinks is going on with the Florida case, cut number one.
There were a lot of people in the courthouse today, Jesse, including Special Counsel Jack Smith and former President Donald Trump, sitting in the same courtroom again for the second time in 2 weeks. But one individual who is not there nonetheless had a major presence, and that is former Special Counsel Robert Hur, who testified earlier this week about his findings related to the willful retention, Joe Biden's willful retention of national defense information, high-level classified documents, but nonetheless, unlike Donald Trump, will face no criminal charges. Both the defense and Judge Cannon repeatedly brought up this phrase, arbitrary enforcement. It is very clear that Judge Cannon is aware of the double standard, not just with Joe Biden, but former presidents Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, and more importantly, former vice presidents Hillary Clinton, Mike Pence, and, of course, Joe Biden. My prediction, Jesse, and I make a lot of predictions on your show, she will not dismiss the two motions before her today, but she will, I believe it's very likely, the Judge Cannon will dismiss this case based on a pending motion on for selective prosecution. It's very clear she is aware of it. She's very upset about it, as you could tell from her comments and conduct today. So that motion is pending on the docket. A hearing has not yet been scheduled, but I would not be surprised if she dismisses this entire case based on selective and biased political prosecution against one man, Donald Trump.
A slight correction, of course, Hillary Clinton was not vice president, but that did have a case of retaining documents. I think you should bear in mind that right now, the Florida case and the Georgia case, and to a lesser extent, the New York case, are really in bad shape. And there's no telling what's going to happen with them, but it's not going to be as cut and dried as it first looked. Well, TikTok may be in trouble. This week, the House of Representatives approved a bill that would force ByteDance, the company that owns TikTok, to sell it to U.S.-held owners, or else TikTok will be banned from the United States. The vote was 352-65, and President Biden has said he will sign the legislation. So there were a lot of yes votes from Democrats and Republicans. A lot of conservatives have come out in favor of this bill. And they are even suggesting that anyone who's not on board with this looks bad. That you're really out there by yourself if you're opposed to the TikTok bill. On the other hand, I think it's interesting that Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Tucker Carlson are all against giving the federal government more power to police social media. In fact, begging the federal government for what Musk calls censorship and control. And we already know what the federal government will do or will try to do when it comes to social media platforms and imposing its will. So the idea that it's somehow conservative to ask them to do more, to me, seems crazy. And I said that yesterday, and I made that case. I want to give you the other side of it, so you can hear what they're saying. And then we'll talk about it. This is a piece of an interview that Brendan Carr, who's the Republican appointee to the Federal Communications Commission, did with Laura Ingraham on Fox News Channel. So Brendan Carr talking to Laura Ingraham about why conservatives should support banning TikTok. Take a listen.
Is the FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, who for years has been warning about the dangers of TikTok. Brendan, you took aim at the theory that this bill applies to all social media platforms. Explain this.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of concern, particularly on the right, whenever Congress does something these days that can be weaponized against them, because we've been living that for so long. My job as a Republican on the FCC is to sound the alarm on anything that can be used for weaponization. Not only does this bill not give that authority to the president, it doesn't rely on that alone. There are five layers of constraints that have been put in here. One, it cannot be used against any individual. Two, it only applies to entities that are controlled by a foreign adversary government, which is just China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Three, it's not enough that you're controlled by a foreign adversary, maybe it should be, you also have to separately have a finding of national security, and then there's additional process beyond that, and the remedy, again, is not a unilateral ban, it is a divestment. So this is a very targeted bill, smart legislation.
So it's not like you can just hop right to, we're going to censor conservatives. That's not how the system was ever set up. But you understand why conservatives think, wait a second, especially after what was done to Donald Trump in the last election. We saw the weaponization of social media platforms. And I would say the collusion of some of these social media CEOs against Republicans in general. So I get it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And look, there's a lot of work we have to do still with big tech. We need to reform Section 230, as President Trump has called for. We need to prevent the discrimination against conservatives. But you can't do any of that with an entity that is beholden to the CCP. Look, TikTok said to us for a long time, no U.S. user data goes back to China. Turns out, leaked material shows everything is seen in China. They told us, don't worry, we're not actually spying on Americans. They now admitted, yes, they were spying on Americans. They then told us, three, don't worry, you caught us. We're going to be better this time. We're walling off China from this data. That was a lie. China still had access.
Justin,
all right,
TikTok
so let me jump in here. I mean, I get what he's saying, and I think you do too, that the Chinese Communist Party has ill intentions and evil purposes toward the United States. It uses any entree into the U.S. economy it can find. We talked a week or two ago about the Chinese-built port cranes. Obviously, they have a checkered history with the Internet, with Internet products, with telecom products. As he mentioned, they've lied about TikTok. And I will give you, I will certainly give you that if you use TikTok, if you've ever used TikTok, your information is in their hands and it has been harvested, and that's all true. The question here, though, is do you fix that by passing a law that gives the feds more power? And did the feds use the powers they already had wisely and well up to this point? Would anybody argue, based on what we've learned about the FBI having meetings with Twitter and Facebook, would anybody argue that that's good for democracy? What would also stop the federal government from defining, for example, X, which is under the control of Elon Musk? What if they were to say, well, we know the law was written for TikTok, and the law says it's things that are under the control of a hostile foreign country. Well, we think Elon Musk is under the control of or taking orders from Putin. So we're going to take the following action or actions against X. And, of course, all of this, underpinning all of this, is our history with the Patriot Act. All the same people that are assuring you this will be limited, this will only be used to defend you, these guns will point outward from the fortress, not inward at the people inside the fortress, those same people made you all those promises about the powers of the Patriot Act, the one that they've been using against U.S. citizens ever since. The battle against TikTok is really coming down to a battle between not Republicans and conservatives. I'm sorry, Republicans and Democrats or liberals and conservatives. It's really a battle between the bipartisan Washington, D.C. establishment, who think that government intervention is the answer to everything, and those of us, including some libertarians, who recognize that more power is likely to be abused. And as scary and chaotic a place as the internet can be, you are better off finding your way, taking your precautions, becoming an educated consumer, than you are yielding control to bureaucrats that have done nothing but show bad will and bad intentions from the beginning. And of course, even if you take them at their word that they only intend this toward TikTok, my answer to that would be, why? Why would, if you believe the Chinese have done all the things they've done with TikTok, and I will grant you they probably have, if you took TikTok away from them, they would just stop? They would fold their hands and mind their P's and Q's? If this is important to them, would they not pursue it through other platforms, other either existing ones or new ones, which then would have to either engender new legislation, or we would find out this legislation actually covers them too, which it probably does. Talking about TikTok and the Trump cases and the survey that says 30% of Gen Z is LGBTQ and all the other things that are happening in our world and in our lives today. And 210-599-5555 will get you in here to be part of the show. Did you see what came out of the CDC this week? They are now saying about COVID that you can pretty much treat it like the flu. So it's taken 4 years for the CDC to say what a lot of people thought at the beginning. Isn't this like the flu? And now they've said it is. We know that masking is mostly ineffective. The vaccine is no more effective than the seasonal flu shot and maybe less so. You can still get it. It's not the bulletproof vest that we were told. Ivermectin, horse paste, turns out to be a therapeutic. And then long COVID. A new Australian study has come out about long COVID, recommending that the term should be discarded because people that have the symptoms that linger after COVID are not markedly different from the people that have symptoms that linger after any other virus. A government-backed research study in Australia says it's time to stop using the term. That there is a phenomenon after most viruses where some people have long-term effects. It wrongly implies there's something unique and exceptional about longer-term symptoms associated with this virus, said one of the authors of the study, Dr. John Gerard. Researchers at Queensland's Health surveyed over 5,000 sufferers aged 18 and older. Long COVID symptoms include fatigue, brain fog, cough, shortness of breath, changes to smell and taste, dizziness, rapid heartbeat. They compared these and the frequency of these symptoms with people that have had other viruses like the flu. It's not happening at a higher rate or with increased frequency with COVID. So there is no long COVID. And at this point, we've now crossed off everything that they threw at us 4 years ago. They have now had to walk back literally everything, every finding, every recommendation, every mandate. 6 feet of separation, closing schools, I mean, everything. Now, here's the thing. We did a show not long ago about how there was no day of reckoning for the people that proclaimed and pronounced all this stuff. In other words, there was no Nuremberg war crimes trial for the people who inflicted so much harm and damage, human and economic, on the world, and were so wrong. And not that you want to hang them or execute them, maybe you do, I don't know, but not that you would do that as was done with Nuremberg, but you would certainly have a formal finding of what was wrong and why it was wrong and a comeuppance and a reckoning, a restating of the facts. Here's what was right, here's what was wrong. Here's why we got it wrong. Here's what we'll do to make sure this never happens again. After every major war, there's always an attempt to defang the villain, right? Sometimes it's unsuccessful or disastrous, like the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, but there's always an attempt to say never again, right? We will never let this happen again. We will never be attacked by this entity in this way ever again. We occupied Japan for several years after World War II to impose on it Western-style democracy that still governs it to this day, meaning there are checks and balances, there are restraints against the use of force, We wanted to be that sure that if we walked away from Japan, it wouldn't rise up again as an aggressive power. But the people that changed the world, I would argue changed the world as if they had waged war on the world, have never had that day of reckoning. And even if you wanted to say, and maybe you feel this way, you know, Jack, it's what's done is done. It's water under the bridge. It was wrong, I agree, but let's move forward. Don't look back, look forward. Even if you want to say that, and maybe you do realize that the same people are pushing climate change models, are pushing energy models, are pushing food supply chain models. They are still at it. Their dreams of world control and social engineering haven't died down in the least. They haven't been humbled. They haven't been slowed down. They don't appear to be reconsidering their own brilliance. So they're still sure they're right, just about different stuff. They're still sure that you've got to do what they say. That's the price, I guess, we pay for not having that day of reckoning. They get to go on, and they're going on. How do we listen to these people ever again? Well, if it was just a question of listening to them, we wouldn't. If they had to get our attention, if they had to persuade us to do things, the people that pushed COVID on you wouldn't be able to persuade most people. You wouldn't even listen. But they're not going to try to persuade you. They're not asking you to please give them a few minutes. They have positions of power and expertise, and they're going to be telling you what to do. And telling the politicians what to do. And since we know politicians are power hungry and like to give orders, anytime anybody gives them sort of the basis to give some more, they're open to it. They're only too happy to bark out some more commands in the name of the science. So add long COVID to the list or the junk pile. The Jack Riccardi Just a Minute video at KTSA.com today says Georgia judge splits the baby. I was making a reference to the Judgment of Solomon. And the Judgment of Solomon story, in case you don't know, Solomon is a judge. He's a wise judge. Two women, both claim to be the mother of a baby. Each insists it's her, not the other one. So Solomon orders that the baby be cut in half, with each woman to receive one half. They don't cut the baby in half. He just gives the order, causing one woman to say, okay, and the other woman to tearfully, frantically beg that they not harm the baby, and she'll give the baby up. And that's how Solomon knows that second mother is the real mother, because she would prefer the baby to live, even if the baby can't live with her. If you actually split the baby dies. If the story went that way, it wouldn't be a story we would cite as wisdom. We'd say that that's maniacal. It's terrible. But that's really what this judge did. He actually split the baby. Judge McAfee is no Solomon. And if he really wanted to leave Fannie Willis in charge of the case, then his report needed to exonerate her. His report needed to say, she's done nothing wrong. She's been good. She's been solid. But he just confirmed in his report everything we saw on television. He recapitulated what we saw with our own eyes and heard with our own ears, but then didn't act on it. Instead saying, you can stay if you make him, Nathan Wade, leave. And they made Nathan Wade leave. Now, I don't know what that will do to the jury, but it definitely sets up an appeal. An appeal that can actually be based on the factual record that McAfee himself laid out in his order. And so some people are now thinking that maybe McAfee just wants this case out of his court. Declare her guilty, but don't excise her from the case. Leave the tumor to grow. And let the next judge deal with it. Or let the Georgia bar deal with it. There's definitely no courage at work in any of these cases. It's all very clear that there's politics, but there's not a lot of courage. And I think this case and the Florida case, where, as we talked about, where the judge seems very taken by the selective enforcement, I think these cases are in trouble. But we'll see. Don't count your chickens yet, right? I always assume when it comes to privacy that I don't have any. I've decided in this world that I'm never going to be surprised to find out that my phone listens to me, the cable box listens to me, smart speakers. I mean, I just assume when I don't know, I just assume. I don't know about you, but I've kind of accepted that we're swimming in waters that are full of microphones and data gatherers, and that's just the way it is. If you don't want those things, if you don't want to live that way, I'm not saying you have to live that way, but if you don't want to live that way, you have to purposely avoid having these devices in your life. So one thing you would have to do, if you really don't accept this world of ours, is you'd have to drive an older car. Because if you're driving a recent model car, I'm pretty sure your car is spying on you and is collecting data. And there's a story that came out in the Wall Street Journal recently about this. And it told the story of some drivers who saw their car insurance go up dramatically in 1 year. And they had not had an accident, which is normally what would drive your rates up. Now, I know that auto insurance is going up in general. I mean, premiums are just going up everywhere. Everybody's premiums are going up. But these people saw big increases, and their insurance agents told them that the price increase was based on data which is collected by third parties from the car's computer and then reported to the insurance companies. So the car companies are gathering the data through the black box in the car. They're selling it to, I think it was LexisNexis, and then turning it around, and it goes to the insurance companies. And, of course, the insurance companies, understandably, want as much data, right, as much actuarial info as they can have. But they also wouldn't mind knowing about you. I mean, it'd be one thing if they were just saying, hey, we've noticed people are driving faster, or something like that. People in this state are driving faster. But how much better if they can actually know how you're driving? And so I would assume that this is happening. I read it. I mean, it is happening. But even before I read it, I kind of assumed it was happening. Did you figure this was already true? Did you know this was true? Is anybody surprised to hear this? Now, I know that some of the car companies have things like OnStar and There's also insurance companies that have offers where if you plug in their stick and agree to share data with them, they'll give you safe driver discounts or whatever they call it. But this is saying that even if you're not a voluntary participant in those things, and for example, the driver that they profiled was not. Well, I guess the driver they profiled, excuse me, had OnStar, but had not signed up for one of those data exchanges with the insurance. So if you have a newer car and it has this kind of linkage, yeah, they've got your data. They know how you're driving. And I don't know how you feel about that. Maybe you don't care. Maybe you don't like it, but you don't know what you can do about it. It's probably the tip of the iceberg. I mean, if it's valuable data, it may not only be valuable to the insurance companies. I don't know. It could be valuable to lots of other companies. There's something about data that once it exists, it always finds a lot of users. They may gather it for one user, but once it exists, it seems like there's ways other people find to tap into it or find value in it. And of course, lurking behind all of them is the government itself. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, and you probably don't do anything that would give you cause for concern. But is it not hypothetically possible that at some point you go to a meeting, go to a rally, go to a political event, where your attendance at it, your presence at it, is something they would want to know? Or use or curate, and your car is telling them? I guess if it's not your car, it's probably your phone, right? Is this crazy to be talking about? And again, I will tell you very honestly, I'm not here advocating that you go off the grid and you buy a 1948 Buick or anything. I have all these things. I have a late model car. I have a smartphone. I'm quite sure if this is possible, I'm quite sure they're doing it with me, and I'm quite sure they have it, and I have decided I don't really care. You know, I've got more of my life in the rearview mirror than ahead of me, and I just don't care. I would rather have the conveniences of these things than not, so I choose to just live with it. But I live with it knowingly. I live with it understanding that it's there. I think that at the very least, we have to have that. We have to know that this is going on. And it's interesting that with all the disclosures of everything these days and the disclaimers you hear with everything, right? I mean, there's disclaimers on every advertisement and every commentary. It's interesting that this stuff is still sort of in the rumor stage. And of course, the automakers have a lot of other applications for this stuff. Like we've talked about in the past, the subscription model for new cars, that new cars are going to have options that are subscription based. They already do. There's going to be more of this. You wanted heated seats. In the old days, you bought the option of heated seats. You owned the heated seats. Now, heated seats are a subscription. And as long as you keep up the subscription, you have heated seats. And if you don't, they turn that off remotely. And other things. And I guess we're in that period of time where they're seeing what they can get away with, and they're seeing what people will question versus what people seem unaware of or uninterested in. And if we're not interested in it and nobody really raises any hackles or concerns, then they'll keep doing it. What do you think about it? How do you feel about it? Because cars are an interesting thing. We say this a lot on this show. Cars are freedom machines. You know, the personal use automobile is the greatest tool of freedom probably since the printed word. And it's transformed freedom, personal freedom, political freedom. It's the most transformative invention probably in human history. And yet, now it has the potential within it to be an encroacher of that freedom. So it's kind of interesting to think about that. I don't know. I like to think about stuff like that. What do you think about it?
You've waited all week. You've been waiting. Monday, you got through it. Tuesday, you got through it. Wednesday, you started to smell it. Thursday, you were right on top of it. And now it's here! It's Friday! It's time to rock and roll! Break out the speakers! Blow your car's engine out! Get home, get to your stuff, and get ready to rock because it's Friday!
Can I tell you a story that I've actually been meaning to get to for months? It's a few months old, but I want to share this with you and see what you think. So back in January, my car was due for the inspection. What am I trying to say? The registration, excuse me. And in order to re-register it, I had to go to the inspection place. I went to a Valvoline that I go to. Not for oil changes. The only time I go there is for the inspection. And I'd been there before. And you drive in, and you go through the whole... You've done this before, Don Cooper, right? You know, turn on your headlights, hit your high beams, horn, just that. So I'm going through the steps. Everything's fine. And then the guy says, all right, pull forward. He hands me the inspection form. So I think we're done. And he says, pull forward. We're going to do the brake test. Did you get this when you did it?
No, not at all.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, because they skipped the brake test on me.
I never had this before. So I thought the brake test would be like, put on the brakes. He goes, pull around to the side of the building. Because, you know, when you pull out of Valvoline, you're right, that's right at the street. So you make a U-turn, pull around the side of the building. Now I'm on the side of the building, facing the back of the property. And he says, when I signal you, go as fast as you can. And then when I signal you again, slam on the brakes.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I did this. I felt like an idiot.
Never heard of this.
And then at the end of it, now... When I stopped, I was way far in the back of the property, like toward the fence at the back of the company property. And the guy is waving at me going, all right, have a good day. He'd already given me the form that said the car had been inspected, had passed inspection. Hmm. I think it was a prank.
I was going to say, I think you've been punked.
I think I was punked. Because I've never had that before. I asked a few people, and they either had never heard of it or couldn't remember if they'd ever done it. But no one I've told that story to said, oh, yes, that's a thing. That they do that.
It's a thing.
I don't know. It seemed a little dangerous, too, because... Yeah. To accelerate rapidly in such a small space, what if I had bad reflexes or my foot slipped? But anyway, I don't know if anybody's heard of that or has any insight on that. I think and I'm not upset about it. I guess these guys got to have their fun, but
I'd go
clearly. It couldn't have been something that would disqualify you because I already had the piece of paper.
Right, you could have just driven off.
I could have just driven off in my faulty brake car, but. Yeah, they, you know, and I knew the brakes were fine and all that, but I think it was just maybe, you know, in every job, people have to make the time go by, and maybe that's just how maybe every third or fourth car, or if they don't like the look of you, or this guy seems like kind of an a-hole or something. I really don't know, but I'd never had that before. I've been getting cars inspected here for 30 years, never had that happen before.
That's a new one.
And... If anyone's heard of that or knows anything about that, let me know.
I'm going to go on YouTube this weekend and check, see if there's a montage of videos. And maybe we might even see you in one of the YouTube
maybe
videos.
Maybe so. Maybe I'm on
different
on a
vehicles.
Punked. a punked YouTube. Anyway.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread had a fight. Beans knocked cornbread out of sight. Beans. Cornbread said, now that's all right. Beans. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night. I'll be ready.
You know, some people just put up with all my nonsense during the week to get to this hour. And I'm okay with that. I'm all right with that. We can work that out. Welcome to this hour of the show we call The Dish at 210-599-5555, where you can talk about your most recent restaurant experience in San Antonio or anywhere around South Texas. It's not a restaurant review. It's the way you would tell a friend or a coworker about a place you discovered or a new restaurant or an old favorite or a story about how a restaurant visit went off the rails somehow. 210-599-5555. Please have the complete name of the restaurant you're calling about. And people love specifics, like what's the best thing on the menu, or what do you recommend they order the first time they go, or what exactly did you have when you went? What made the place so great, or what made the experience not so great? You can praise or zing.
Anyway, am I allowed to take any questions?
That's right. Praise or zing at 210-599-5555. And along the way, we'll gather up your votes in the JR poll and have results on the poll question right before 7 o'clock here on KTSA. And a big thank you, by the way, to everyone who called last night about the best concert you've ever seen. We got some great calls, had some great emails about that. If you didn't get through and you wanted to get in on that, I strongly recommend you use the Jack Chat line and leave us your concert memories there at 210-599-5550. We'll play those back. Or you can shoot me an email, jack@ktsa.com. But we're going to start with some restaurants and go from there. By the way, speaking of concerts, little bit of sad news. I did not know this. The inventor of the karaoke machine has died. I really didn't think of this as having an inventor. You don't think of one person, but a man named Shigeichi Nagishi, a Japanese engineer, has passed away at the age of 100. It was announced yesterday, although he actually died in January after suffering a fall, according to his family. He got the idea for the karaoke machine in 1967 after a colleague quipped that he had a terrible singing voice. And Nagishi said he thought if only people could hear a singing voice with a backing track. So, although others have claimed credit, he apparently is the man that first developed what he called the Sparko Box. It was the first karaoke machine to come to the marketplace. And so he gets the distinction of being the father of karaoke. It was a huge device, by the way. It wasn't as compact as they are today. He had an interesting life. He was drafted into the Japanese military and wound up as a POW, learned English as a POW, and learned, as a result of learning English, went into the business of sales, selling cameras and electronics. He started his own electronic company. He liked singing. He would sing along with programs on the radio and the television, and he always thought he might sound better if he had a backing track, so he developed a device with a microphone, a speaker, and a tape deck so that people could have karaoke. And I don't know whether we should honor him or hold him responsible, but anyway, he's the man that made many a bachelor and bachelorette party possible. So rest in peace, Mr. Nagishi. All right, let's talk restaurants here on The Dish. I can think of no better way to start this Friday night than with Gennaro. Who's probably done a karaoke a time or two in his life.
Oh, man, dude.
Right? Am I right or am
I
right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
I actually played the tambourine.
I knew it. I just knew it.
Okay, so Golden Kareen is at 4400 Fredericksburg Road, Suite 122. And I've been there about like three times, and I actually came across a dish called Tam Lu Wonton. It's under our chef specialties number 6. And it's a combination of shrimp, pork, breast of chicken, and golden fried wontons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and it's tossed in a sweet and sour sauce. Now, the thing they don't tell you is the wontons are huge. They're like, they're three wontons, and they're huge. And they put pineapple rings over the wontons.
Wow.
Yeah. Now the thing is, man, I every time I go in there, I can only eat a little bit, and then I have enough for like lunch and dinner the next day. And it is great. It's a little place. It's quiet. The service is good. They got little dishes that other Chinese restaurants don't have. I like it. I recommend it to everybody. And I mean, it's great, man.
I'm trying to think where along Fredericksburg that is. What is that near? Is it near like the, I'm trying to think what that would be near. It's on Fredericksburg. It's probably inside 410, right?
It's right, and I'm not going to promote the other Chinese restaurant, but it's in Balcones Heights, Caddy Corner to Crossroads or Wonderland of the Americas or whatever the hell it's called now.
Whatever we're calling it now. Okay.
Yeah.
So 4400 Fredericksburg Road, Golden Kieran Restaurant.
Suite 122, the number 6.
Okay. Got the chef specialty number 6.
It's called Tam Lu Wonton.
All right.
And you're going to have Gennaro for sent a couple you. Of days.
And they'll say, who? All right, yeah. Gennaro, you have a good weekend, sir. Thank you. Praise for Golden Kieran in Balcones Heights. It did sound good, though. I have to say, it did sound good. 210-599-5555 on the dish. And Tricia is next on the radio. Hi, Tricia.
Hey.
Hey.
So, yeah, we discovered Papa Nacho's in Leon Springs Tuesday for lunch, and it was awesome. We actually live in Fredericksburg, and my son goes to UTSA, so my mom and I were like, hey, let's check this place out. It was great. So I had cheese enchiladas. Mom got a puppy tacos, and we split both of them. It was great. Service was great. Everybody was super friendly. So we'll definitely be back.
Now, this is the place that's up on I-10 near, like, Bernie Stage Road?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's like, kind of, the only thing Mom had to say about it is she goes, I should have sat on the other side of the table because she stared at the HEB gas station the whole time.
Well, you know, I mean, that doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah. So, anyway, it was great. We'll definitely be back.
I'm glad you liked it. And yeah, it's funny. We had a call about this place exactly 2 years ago. Was the last call we had on Papa Nacho's. So Tricia likes the puffy tacos and the cheese enchiladas. We had a call praising it 2 years ago. Said the service was great. The refills were constant. Another call from 3 years ago praising the Texas burrito, which is an item on the menu that's really big. So, Papa Nacho's, 24145 IH10. It's in a shopping center called The Market at Bernie Stage. And you're on The Dish. Jack Riccardi Show, The Dish Hour, where we're talking restaurants. You can praise or zing your most recent restaurant experience right now. So, it could be a new place. It could be new to you. It could be an old favorite you're singing the praises of. It could be a story about how things went off the rails. 210-599-5555, and Paul is on the radio. Happy Friday night, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I went to a place called Classic Pizza. It's on 3440 North St. Mary's. It's right at the entranceway to the zoo. off of St. Mary's. A lot of people go in there and they have pizza. They're constantly walking out with pizzas. I went in and I had, and this is my second time there, having a meatball sandwich. And the first time was very impressive, and the second time was even better. What they do that's different, usually you get a meatball sandwich, and it's got a big old meatball, two or three of them in there, and it's hard to bite. I mean, it's hard to get around.
Right.
And, right? They cut them in half. Mm-hmm. And they embed them into the sandwich, and they mm-hmm. cover it with cheese. I mean, it is awesome. But they topped it with one thing. You know how Italian bread is supposed to have be hard on the outside and doughy and soft on the inside?
Right, right.
The outside was crispy, like they baked it high or something.
Mm.
And when you bit into it, it was crispy, and
I
the
like
inside
that.
Was delicious. I said, God, man, I couldn't get any more perfect.
Wow, that sounds perfect. I mean, I've been there before, and I the pizza's pretty good. I have not yet tried the meatball sub, but you've convinced me I have to try it.
And one other place I'd like to give a blessing to.
Well, hold on. And before we leave that place, hold on, Paul. Before you go to the second place, I just want to make sure we're clear. I think it's actually called Pizza Classics, right?
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. It's 3440 North St. Mary's, so praise for the meatball sub there.
Oh, yeah.
And then what is the other place you wanted to mention?
It's an Italian deli called Zito's. There's two of them. I just went there tonight at the Babcock location. And I took a guest that's never been, and she had the Delight. And it's called a sandwich called the Delight. It's a ham with provolone, and she thoroughly liked it. And, you know, I had the roast beef sandwich, which I always love. But the thing about it is, the sandwiches were so juicy and good, my fingers were all full of oil. and it was a delicious thing. You know, it's like, my God, this is a mess, but it's good.
Yeah. Hey, some of the best sandwiches, they're messy to eat. That's how you know they're good. Yeah, Zito's is a legend over there. The original location is up there at 8800 Broadway. And then they have that location you mentioned on Babcock. Yeah, you know your sandwiches, Paul. You know your way around sandwiches. Good man. Good call. Thank you for calling the dish. Praise for Pizza Classics and Zito's on the dish. There you go. 210-599-5555 to praise or zing your most recent restaurant experience. They're going after pizza places in New York City. That's the new Big Brother government initiative. They've got a plan to require pizza places and matzo bakeries that use the wood and coal-fired stoves to have to cut back and either spend a lot of money on filters and systems or else cut back on their usage. And I guess there's going to be some carve-outs and some variances, but it's just like one thing after another that people enjoy. You know, they have a list of everything we love and everything we like and everything that brings us a little pleasure. Imagine New York City cracking down on pizza joints. That's sounds impossible. What's next? Well, no, don't even ask. We'll see what happens with that. But that's the latest. We thought it was bad when they were going after the size of soft drinks. Those seem like the good old days now. 210-599-5555 as we talk restaurants and of all kinds on the dish. And we get to Tony here next on KTSA. Happy Friday night, Tony.
Hey, Jack. Good to get on here. I grew up in Boston, too, and I went to Don Bosco downtown right by the Common. And at Park Street Station, they used to have that pizza place right there. It was a quarter of a slice back when I was a young kid. And I found a place that actually has pizza that's just as good. It's Ray's Pizzeria on McCarty, or as we used to say back in the neighborhood, McCarty. And we go there, you know, whenever we're off of San Pedro, top of San Pedro, right by the Mazda dealership there, and it's in the strip mall. But they've got lunch specials, two slices for I think it was like $10, and then you get one slice and a salad for $10. So It's real good. New York style. It's got a little burn on the bottom, you know. So hopefully we don't have it taken away from us. But but yeah. That,
you know, I've seen that name in other places. I don't know if there's more than one of those or if they're not all related.
No, they used to have three. They had one up there at 1604 and 281, but COVID got that one. And there was also one in Universal City. That's the one I used to go to when I lived up there. So, but the only one surviving, I just bumped into it about a year ago, and because I thought they were all gone, and and they were there. They were in that little strip mall there, right there, right behind. I think it's an Arby's in that area.
That's good to know. I know exactly where you are. I used to get a haircut in that same strip center. There's a church on one end of the strip center. I think there's a couple of other little restaurants in there.
Nice little Mexican place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Ray's Pizzeria, 455 McCarty, off of San Pedro, kind of across the street from the back lot of the Mazda dealership, right?
Yeah, and you know, the old, Alamo Cafe used to be across the street there from McCarty. So, you know, the original Alamo Cafe, now is the north... is a car dealership now, but when they moved up a little bit up 281, but that was the original location of the old Alamo Cafe there on San Pedro.
All right. Good stuff. Right. Ray's Pizzeria, 455 McCarty. Tony, have a great weekend. Thank you for the call, sir. Good to have you on our show. Praise for Ray's Pizzeria on the dish. And we have had calls over the years about Ray's, but they were other locations. So he says this is the one that remains. This is the one that's left at 455 McCarty off of San Pedro.
Caught in a quicksand, and I'm starting to sing. I need someone to help me, but I don't know which way to turn. I know I don't have much of a choice. I'll go out of my mind or into the night.
Second half hour of the dish. Your calls at 210-599-5555 to praise or zing your most recent restaurant experience, maybe lunch today, maybe dinner last night, maybe a special occasion, maybe a new place you discovered this week. And Roger is next on the dish. Happy Friday, Roger.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on the show. Hey, first of all, I need to hook up with that guy that plays the tambourine. We could start a band. I play the cowbell.
Oh, man, I don't know whether I should bring you together or keep you apart.
I want to talk about the brown bag. I recently discovered them, and I went in there to get a chicken salad sandwich, and I did not expect it to be so thick. It was piled high, the chicken salad, and the tuna salad is excellent. They got a big variety of sandwiches there, and I didn't plan on leaving with dessert, but their carrot cake, the German chocolate cake, all looked wonderful, and I ended up getting German chocolate cake, and it's homemade to me, you know. It's really good.
Yeah, that place has been around a long time, and I know they have a good reputation for catering. They do a lot of box lunches and catering and stuff like that. I guess that's where the name comes from. But yeah, how big inside is it? If you go in, like, how many tables are there?
They have probably about four or five tables in the back for seating.
Yeah.
And
so most people are getting it to go, like you did, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that's on Wetmore. It's 11035 Wetmore Road. Is it in a little strip center?
No, it's a standalone. It's a standalone building, right? In a cutout of the airport property, and it's between Broadway and Wurzbach Parkway.
Perfect. Good way to locate it. So up there on Wetmore near the airport, 11035 Wetmore Road, the Brown Bag. Roger, have a great weekend. Great job on that. Thank you, sir. We used to get a lot of calls about the Brown Bag. We haven't in many years, so I'm glad to know they still exist. And it's good to get them back on the dish. 210-599-5555. Praise or zing your most recent restaurant experience. We've been heavy on the sandwiches and pizza tonight, which is good, which is fine, you know, whatever. It's funny how it distributes that way, though. Some nights we'll have a bunch of barbecue calls. Some nights we'll have a bunch of sandwich calls. Other nights it's a bunch of, I don't know, sushi, just different things, just oddly distributed. Do you have Are you a joiner? Do you have like rewards cards and frequent this cards and VIP customer, you know, different things like that? There was a woman in, I think this was somewhere in the Midwest, maybe Nebraska, somewhere like that. She had the rewards card for her gas station or local gas station. And she discovered, you know, when you have that, you scan it at the pump. She discovered that if you scanned it twice, I don't know if I should even be telling you this because I don't want anybody to try it, but it's out there, so I'm going to tell you. Somehow she discovered, and probably this wouldn't work anywhere else, that if you scanned it twice, it put the pump into what's called demonstration mode. I don't know. Never heard of that. Well, in demonstration mode, she could fill up for free. And that is not part of the, you know, rewards program. It is a reward, but it's not one of the rewards they intended. So she started doing it. And the company started noticing they were being scammed. And there was a glitch that had occurred in a software update that they didn't realize was there. And she probably discovered it accidentally. But she was not only using the hell out of it, but she was letting other people use her card. I guess she was operating like a side business. She would charge them something. They would go with her rewards card and fill up. And the card was used hundreds of times to the expense of thousands of gallons of gas that were pumped for free, which also is hard for me to understand because it sounds like somebody wasn't minding their P's and Q's on the business end of this. But anyway, she's been arrested. She's been charged. She's violated apparently a number of laws. I'm sure her defense will be if they didn't want me to do it, they should have not made it possible to do. Don't try this at home, kids. Don't try this with your rewards card. But anyway, that's what happened.
And there's a lesson learned too as well.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the good news for her now is for quite some time, she's not going to have to buy any gas. So she will not be, she will not only not be paying full price for gas, mm-hmm. she won't be buying it at all. So there you go.
Well, don't share in your good fortune. You know, that's what probably
yeah, you
was
do
her
wonder,
downfall,
like, if she
know?
Had just done it herself and not abused it to the point, I mean, 500 times, come on, you know. If she just maybe bought gas once a week and just filled her own tank, not that still would have been stealing, but I mean, she might have gotten away with it. But everybody sees an angle, right? Everybody's got a little larceny. 210-599-5555. We talk restaurants on the dish, and Daniel is next. Daniel, welcome to the show. Happy Friday.
Thanks, Jack. I was just wanting to let you know about a place I found in Castroville by accident. We were just finished working on a car, and we're driving up Petranco Road till the very end, then decided, hey, let's go into Castroville, look for something to eat. And just across the Medina River Bridge is this little old town section with little shops. And this place called Rock and Tapas caught our eye. Mm-hmm. It's really a neat place. It's under all these huge trees. The restaurant looks really nice. It has a huge patio in the front that's all, you know, brickworked and stuff. It's more of an Italian-type Mediterranean restaurant. Of course, we ate outside. It was a real nice evening. We went inside to just check it out, and it's nice size, not real huge inside. They had two people playing, I think one person playing guitar, one playing some drums or something. And then upstairs, they had a little private room if you want to reserve it, kind of like Cappy's has. And it's kind of like rock memorabilia around, and all their whole menu is nothing but rock and roll names, like the Hendrix, NXS, the Elvis, the Who, Pearl Jam. And it's kind of fun. I had this thing called the Elvis, which was like three meatballs, tomato sauce, and some fried potatoes. And it was really hearty. My friend had the Joplin, which was a salad, which had like lettuce, cheese, and some other stuff that was really amazing, too. And they also have a lot of pizzas. Y'all were talking about pizzas earlier. They have different kind of pizzas, which are really neat. You know, R.E.M., Abba, the Doors pizzas. Kind of cool place. So I just wanted to mention that.
Well, that does sound cool. I can't believe we've never heard of that before. Never had a call on that before. I'm looking at it here. It says 307 Lafayette Street. Is that like a little side street off the main drag? Or?
Yeah, there's like a little triangle, which is like a little park grassy area, and it's right behind that next to another little cafe. I didn't try that cafe, but it was lit up at nighttime with all these little patio light things, you know, going across the outdoor area, and it's really neat. I was really surprised. The food was amazing. And we met some people there. We were just talking to them, and they sat down with us, and they were having some different things, too, and they were telling how much they like it. So they're from Castroville themselves.
So it's next to Castroville Cafe. Is that the cafe you were talking about?
Yes. I didn't go to that one, but I want to try that one. It looks really nice. It was closed at the time.
So this place is just off Petranco, 307 Lafayette. It's Rock and Tapas. Very good. Daniel, thanks for the call. Great job. That sounds really intriguing, like a place definitely worth taking a little extra ride for, drill a little extra drive for. Another first-timer on the dish. First time we've had that one on the dish. 210-599-5555. Don't forget, this show, including the Dish Hour, is always available as an on-demand podcast that you can get at ktsa.com or anywhere you like to find your other podcasts. So if you're able to catch up with our show on the weekends or later on at night, we welcome that and encourage that. And in fact, more and more people are doing that. More and more people listening when they want, where they want, through the device they want, to the podcast of the Jack Riccardi Show. I saw an interesting story today. I think there's no end to the fascination with the Titanic, right? And I saw a story today that I had never heard before, and I don't know if you've heard it. And it was about the man who was the head baker, the head pastry chef on the Titanic. His name was Charles Jofen. I think I'm saying that right. And he survived the sinking of the Titanic. And there is some question as to how he survived it. But his story is that on the night in question, and remember, the Titanic was on its maiden voyage and was the creme de la creme. It had the best of everything. So you would imagine that the culinary staff was the best. The food was the best. The drink was the best. The pastry chef was obviously a very talented guy for his time. And he was considered kind of a hero of this night because he sort of rallied the kitchen staff to assist in the process of evacuating passengers and getting them onto lifeboats. But while he was doing it, remember, it was a cold, icy cold night. While he was doing it, he would step below deck and have a nip of whiskey. He did this multiple times during the course of the hours of evacuation of the Titanic. So they were getting people into the boats, tossing people into the boats, throwing things overboard that could be used as flotation devices so people in the water could grab onto a chair or a piece of furniture or something. So this went on for hours, and he would help, and then he would go below and get a drink, and then he would help, and then he would go below and get a drink. And the ship started to sink. And he was able to climb up onto the stern of the Titanic. And according to witnesses, he stepped down the stern into the water like he was stepping down a staircase. In fact, he entered the water so gracefully he didn't get his hair wet. And he was floating in the water. He did not get on board a lifeboat. But he was treading water for hours, all night. Many people froze to death very quickly, but help came in the morning and he was alive. And they now think the reason he survived when so many people died of hypothermia or cardiac arrest was all the alcohol. He had drunk so much whiskey that his blood vessels didn't respond the way to the freezing water the way they did in other people. He felt warm, and therefore he didn't panic or give up, and he survived. They don't recommend that you try this, but it's one of the legends of the Titanic. I had not heard that story until today, so. Is there a moral to that story? I will leave that to you. But he survived to bake some tarts another day on another ship. Let's get one more here on the dish before we run out of time, and Robert is on the radio. Robert, happy Friday to you.
Hey, Jack, how are you? That's a really tough act to follow.
It is, but I know you can do it.
Oh, man, I'll try. Mr. A-OK's Soul Food over in Windcrest. You know, so I was born in East Texas, loved some soul food, found this place. I had two deep-fried bone-in pork chops with cornbread, collard greens, and fried okra.
Boy, that sounds good.
You know, exactly. I mean, it's in a little strip mall, really approachable staff, nothing fancy. I highly recommend it.
You know, they must have moved, because we used to get calls on them years ago when they were on Riddiman.
I think it's on Riddiman.
Well, I'm looking online here, and it says it's on Walsham.
Okay, it could be. I'm 4 years in San Antonio. I'm a little fuzzy on the exact location, yeah. But it's definitely in Windcrest.
Yeah, no, you're right, and those streets are just one street off of each other. But yeah, their website says 5532 Walsham, so I'm sure it's the same place, and they probably just relocated.
They have not moved lately.
Yeah. What else have you had there that's good? Have you had anything else that you'd recommend besides the deep fried pork chops?
Actually, I've only been the one time.
Okay.
Everything smelled great. You know, there were people in there, and they looked like they'd done it before. You know, a lot of to go happening, but it was great. I mean, if you need a little East Texas or Southeast in you, that's a spot.
That sounds great. Hey, if you go again, call me and tell me what else is good.
I will do it, Jack.
I will look forward to that. Robert, you have a good night, sir. Thank you for listening to us. Thanks for calling the show. Praise for Mr. A-OK's 5532 Walsham.
Thank God it's Friday.
And, you know, I think the American people get it. If you take a look at, I know the press is here and they're all wonderful people. I don't know why they don't like me a lot more than Trump, but the way he talks about you guys, man, anyway, that's a joke. I'm kidding. I shouldn't even be kidding with you. I'll pay a price for having said that.
Thank God it's
we just don't deserve his humor. He'll pay a price. All right, on the JR poll, do you like Bernie Sanders' idea for a 4-day work week mandated by law? Nobody did. 100% no on that. New JR poll Monday when we get started at 4. I noticed there's a lot of restaurant history in the news today. This was the day in 1965 that the first TGI Fridays opened up. I somehow think of that as having a beginning. It seems like they've just always been there. But the first ever TGI Fridays was in New York City on East 63rd, this day in 1965. This is also the fateful day in 1980 that McDonald's first test marketed the McNugget. Knoxville, Tennessee was the test market. They were a monster success, leading to the spread of McNuggets across the land.
Wow.
And as far as I'm concerned, McNuggets are the gateway drug to the McRib, so one thing leads to another. But, yeah, there you go.
They're called Nugs now.
Nugs. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. The kids call them Nugs now. Well, actually, that's from that ad with Andy Reid, right? Yes, I called think, them I think nugs.
Yes.
Yeah, nuggies. All right. Well, you didn't need to know that, but now you do. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here live Monday, or look for the Jack Riccardi Show podcast.